I'm Abby Kinney, and you are listening to Upzoned. Hello, and thank you for listening to another episode of Upzoned, where we take a story each week that touches the Strong Towns conversation, and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth. My name's Abby Kinney, planning consultant with Gould Evans, working from home, and joined with us this week is our regular co-host, Chuck Marone. Thanks for meeting with me this week, Chuck.
Hey, Abby. It's really nice to be here. Gryffindor and I are happy. He just decided he was going to come in the studio when I was recording. So my dog is sitting here very nicely, listening to my half of the conversation. Really happy to be here. So thanks.
What a coincidence, because my dog is actually in the same room with me. She doesn't always hang out when I'm recording these. Sometimes she just wants to be in a different room alone, but I've moved my office downstairs into a guest room this week. Since there's a bed down here, she actually wants to hang out in here.
Very cool. You know, I know a lot of us are getting to experience working at home with pets. I work at home all the time, so I always do this. But the weird thing is having the kids. They're a little more intense than pets, and they'll just stomp in the middle of something and want you to solve it. And, you know, I feel for the people who have toddlers. That's for sure.
Yeah, me too, definitely. So today we're going to be talking about a pretty interesting study published by Michael Pagano and Christina McFarlane with the Brookings Institute entitled, When Will Your City Feel the Fiscal Impact of COVID-19? This study examines the extent to which a number of cities' tax revenues, like retail, sales, income, and real estate, rely on sources that are impacted more quickly by economic fluctuations. Their methodology basically takes data from 2019 to measure two different categories that would impact the financial well-being of cities. The first category is that they identify the share of general fund revenues that come from what they're calling elastic sources. So like sales and income taxes, as opposed to property taxes, which are just not as easily changed because that would require a local reassessment of property values, whereas sales and income tax can decline much more immediately. The second thing that they measured is the share of metro employment in high-risk industries, which they've defined as mining, oil and gas, transportation, employment services, travel arrangements, and leisure and hospitality. In looking at these industries, they basically measure how much they think municipal budgets will be impacted by the shutdowns. Their main inferences suggest that cities with a high proportion of employment in high-risk industries and a tax structure that's reliant on elastic sources of revenue will feel the pain more quickly than others. Of course, now that we have a $2 trillion stimulus package, $150 billion will be provided for state, county, and municipal government support for municipal governments that have populations over 500,000 people, which is a threshold that is causing some contention in my city, I know. Something that I think is interesting about this study is that it touches a little bit on the idea that COVID-19 did not bring on the fact that we are fragile. I think it's important that we recognize that many of our cities are fragile to begin with. The sheer amount of infrastructure that local governments are responsible for maintaining is overwhelming when you consider that your city's revenue stream basically relies on much more than just property taxes to support the essential services that the properties rely on, like streets. Chuck, I think you once said that cities are overbuilt on the public side and underbuilt on the private side in a lot of cases. Instead of making property taxes more proportional to infrastructure liabilities, many cities have opted to rely on more revenue streams that are less stable, like income and sales tax. And in my city, I know that sales, income, and tourism taxes make up a third of our revenue budget. And we've really progressed our city in a lot of ways to lean into those revenue sources.
Well, you look at it right now, and there's no question that the places that have the volatile tax structures are the ones that are going to be hit the quickest and the hardest. I don't think anyone will be spared ultimately, but let's focus on those first, because when we talk about places as being fragile, what we're really talking about is their ability to respond to volatility. When there's volatility in the market, and volatility is essentially a condition of things that were unexpected. So 9/11 created volatility. The housing crisis in 2008 created volatility. That going back further, the dot-com crash created volatility. The hedge fund meltdown on Wall Street in the mid-90s created volatility. So it's not like volatility is something that is rarely experienced. We're experiencing a lot of volatility. In fact, the last decade of kind of suppressed volatility is the way I would describe it, is really the odd situation. If you're in a place where you are dependent on suppressed volatility, on really no volatility at all in order to sustain where you're at, you are incredibly fragile. A lot of these cities, and I think this is the worst situation, took their volatile sales tax structures, and there's different degrees of volatility in sales tax, but let's just, you know, look at like a blanket one where everything from haircuts to getting your car washed to buying food, it's all taxed. If you look at that, if you had that kind of a system and then you went out and took on a bunch of debt, assuming that you would have that money there, you are like extremely fragile, because now not only is that money going away, but it's not like you can say, well, we'll put off that road maintenance project for a year, or we'll put off, you know, salary increases for a while, or we'll do a furlough or lay off some people. You're literally looking at like, how do we make our debt payment? And we have some cities, you know, particularly on the smaller end, where I've even seen one city where 55% of their revenue went to debt service. What do you do in that situation? You're just essentially reduced to being a machine for collecting taxes and paying debt. This is extremely fragile. And I think the article rightly points out that these places are, you know, going to feel it first. And Minnesota does this from a statewide perspective. And there's a little bit of this locally, but not as much. The state will feel a huge hit from this because we don't tax non-discretionary spending. So like clothes does not get sales tax. Most food does not get sales tax. But like anything you'd eat at a restaurant is taxed. Anything that is like discretionary spending. So buy a car, buy a diamond ring, buy like whatever. Those things are all discretionary, and that money's just going to go away. And that's a huge part of the state's budget. Is your city that way? I mean, is that how Kansas City is? Because there's a lot of cities that run that way, and it's freaky for them right now.
You know, I don't know how much of the funds we use for debt service, but I do know that we rely on a lot of sales tax and taxes that just come from tourism and things like that. This really makes me think about just how money management really works at the individual level, and this is scaled up. And what's interesting about this is if it wouldn't work for an individual, it shouldn't work for a collective of individuals that is a city. When I was a college student, probably between the ages of 18 and 24, I worked as a server at a restaurant. And the income that servers make is heavily reliant on how much money people spend and their proportion of the bill that they tip you. Servers do make a small hourly rate, but that really only covers taxes, if that. But during this time, I came to understand how fragile this was as an income stream. If business was booming during the first half of the month, I basically had to learn not to assume that business was going to be just as good in the second half of the month. If I did that, and I did make that mistake a few times, I exposed myself to the possibility of having to make large compromises in order to pay my rent and bills. It was important that I understand that I couldn't make assumptions, because whether or not people go out to restaurants and spend money in general is so highly dependent on a number of factors that are out of my control, out of my employer's control, out of the city's control. Forget economic conditions. Even bad weather can deter people from going out and spending money. In a rational world, we would be wise to tie essential services provided by a city to the most stable tax revenue source that we have, which in my mind is property taxes. Redirecting how we use property taxes would allow us to see that the value derived from property does not support the infrastructure and other essential services needed to support it, even if we just rationalize how we spent less stable revenue sources like sales tax on non-essentials, I think that we'd be in better shape. When you have a local economy that is so heavily dependent on sales and income tax, it is inherently unstable because those two revenue sources are incredibly sensitive to the market. And by market, I mean how all of us are participating in our local economy and spending money. During budget season, we as citizens tend to pay a lot of attention to how money is going to be spent each year. But I'd really encourage people to look at your budget and understand where the revenue is coming from. This not only gives you an idea of what your city's fiscal position is going to look like moving forward, but it also might help you understand what is driving decision-making of local leadership. It's sort of all baked into the tax structures. If the tax structures we humans set up are making us unstable, I kind of wonder why we don't choose to revisit them when things like this expose that.
I think one of the reasons is, I mean, at the end of the day, we might. I think it's very easy to get complacent because we've had this long period of suppressed volatility. Nassim Taleb talks about this, and he talks about suppressing volatility as opposed to eliminating it or reducing it. And his argument, and I agree with this, is that you really can't get rid of it. You can only put it off. And when you put it off, it magnifies it. So you can have a little bit of tension and a little bit of stress all the time, and then you learn to deal with it. And he would call this an anti-fragile system, systems that become stronger day after day. Or you can put it off and put it off and put it off. I think what we see here is that post-2008, we encouraged cities to take on lots of debt. We encouraged cities to view the world and experience the world as if every day would be a sunny day, and to feel very confident about their future. And, you know, we also kind of had this implied notion that if anything went wrong, the federal and state government would be there to bail them out and to backstop them. And as you say, you know, with some of the very, very large cities, that may happen to a degree. But for the most part, I think we are going to find what we've said at Strong Hands here for a long time. We're going to be on our own at the local level. I want to paint a picture for you and have you respond to this notion. Because if we go back in time and we look at cities, even 100 years ago in the United States, if you went to Kansas City 100 years ago, you were going to see a lot of buildings that were not the greatest buildings, were maybe in early stages of development, you know, private sector things. But if you went to the government buildings and you went to the banks, what you were going to see in those types of places were these granite columns, marble staircases, opulence that was far beyond maybe what even prudence would suggest. The reason why, and there's a lot of architectural and social, and we talk sometimes about urban design reasons, but one of the other reasons why your bank has marble staircases and your city had a dome and pillars is it was trying to express to the community stability. We are here. We are such a rock solid institution that you can feel confident putting your money in my bank. You can feel confident investing in our municipal corporation. You can feel confident moving to this place and being part of what we're doing because we are rock solid. We have rock solid balance sheets. We've got rainy day funds. We're taking care of business. If everything goes bad, you can count on us to be here. When we look at cities today, there's like, no, I mean, banks are one thing, and I don't think banks, you know, have this kind of sense about them anymore either, clearly. But when we look at local governments, we have really allowed them to become captured by this notion that it doesn't matter what your local balance sheet is. Your city does not have to be a conservatively run place. And by conservatively run, I don't mean Fox News versus MSNBC. I mean prudent with their day-to-day finances, not taking huge risks, not engaging in things that could put the community as a whole in jeopardy. You know, being able to be there in a tough time when you need it. We've gotten so far away from that. And I I hope that if the lesson of this whole thing, you know, for local governments is one thing, it's that we need you. Like in a time of crisis, we need local government. And so you can't be risky. You can't be the ones hung out to dry. You can't be the ones who are not able to step up during times like this, because it's times like this that it's essential that you be there.
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly interesting point. Of course, the opulence of public buildings has become less and less important, particularly in some of the newer cities. In Kansas City, you know, the actual historic city, we have our historic building stock, so we still have remnants of that. But it does surprise me that there seems to be a sense that cities don't necessarily need to be run in a way that, I guess, I don't want to say makes a profit, but is stable in terms of revenue and in expenditures.
I would go a step further. You know, I would go a step further. And I've actually, as part of doing engineering work and planning work in cities, was in many meetings where the city was looked at as like the playmaker, like the kingmaker. Like the city is the patient money that can take the crazy risks. The city is the one who can go in and make all these deals happen. The city's the one who can do the tax subsidies that like no private business would do because it doesn't make any sense at all. The city has become like the person who funds, you know, backstops all the speculators, all the risky people. And that is literally like the opposite of what a city should be. A city should be like the adult in the room, the most prudent and fiscally conservative player in the game.
Well, that's what you would think, because it is all of our money that, like, I think a lot of people forget that the city is not like this abstract concept. It is all of us together. It's a collective of people, and the money that we are paying in taxes, I think that we should be holding people accountable to spend it prudently and to, you know, really be careful about how we're building our city in conjunction with that.
You said earlier, you compared a city to a family. And I know there were a lot of people out there listening who just reflexively said, no, 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 governments and families, that's not the right analogy. And the reason is because they watch too much national cable TV and read too many national publications. Because there's this emerging train of thought over the last decade or two that you cannot draw an analogy between a family and a national economy. Okay, like I don't even want to have that debate. Like, go ahead and believe that. That's fine. I think that there are actually like legitimate theories that talk about that. And that's a legitimate point of view that I don't want to actually debate. A city is not like that. A city is not like the federal government. A city is very much like a family. It is very much like, it does have like real world fiscal constraints. And you can even be one of these people who think, well, the federal government should, you know, print all the money that they need and go in and help every city and fix all these problems. Okay, that's fine. But at the end of the day, if you are running a city, you have real revenues. You have real expenses. You do not get to print your own money. You do not get to make stuff up. You do not get to count on outside players coming in and bailing you out if it's a disaster. I mean, you're responsible to the community. We're responsible to each other. At the end of the day, that's what it comes down to. Here's how I would put it. Cities should never be in the position of taking risk with things that we absolutely must have in an emergency. You know, so things that we must absolutely have in a crisis that should never, ever be threatened at the local level. And today in many cities, it is absolutely threatened. And we're 4 weeks in, 5 weeks in.
Right. And it is really concerning to me, the fact that you would think that cities would have to be accountable for spending money in the most fiscally conservative way in order to maintain what we have long term. If you don't do that, then that means that cities must rely on some other entity like the state or the federal government to bail them out when things like this happen. To me, that seems like not a position that cities would want to be in. That is inherently unsustainable.
Let's take the family analogy another step further, right? If your like grandfather is Warren Buffett, you might not have to worry about how you spend your money day to day, right? Like, you know, if you wind up destitute and you wind up like really in a crisis and a time of need, if something happens, there's wealth in your family and someone's going to come and take care of you. You're not going to starve to death. But if your grandfather is like completely underwater themselves financially, like has all the sharks after them because of the debts they owe, are completely insolvent, seem to have no like sense of their own prolificacy, have made like massive commitments all over the place that they're struggling to bear, you better shore up your own finances, right? Like that's not someone that you can rely on. We talk sometimes at Strong Towns about macroeconomics, and it's not to get in this debate with people over their economic religion at the federal level, because economics at the federal level is often applied to politics, and you believe certain things economically because you believe certain things politically and back and forth. I don't really care about any of that. Like, believe what you want. The reality is, if you're a local government, if you are in a community trying to do something collectively with your neighbors, you can't really look at the federal government, no matter what party you have established yourself with, and say, that seems like a really stable institution that I'm going to, you know, pin the future of my community to. That's essentially what we've done. We're 22 minutes in and we haven't even talked about property tax or anything.
No, that's totally fine. I mean, it's an interesting thing to wonder if our federal government is Warren Buffett or the crazy grandpa who gambled away all the money.
I get the theories that suggest that the federal government has, you know, the capacity to spend and the capacity to spend a lot more money than they do today. I get that. And maybe that will be borne out to be true. I mean, maybe we'll spend trillions of dollars here in the coming few months to years, and there will be no ramifications for that. Maybe. But here's the thing. At the very least, that's a theory that is debatable. That's an experiment now we're running. And it's kind of one of these pass-fail experiments. Like, if that theory is correct and we can print as much money as we need and there's really no ramifications to this long term, great. Then we'll do that and everyone will be vindicated and they can tweet that they were right and Chuck Marone was wrong, or what, you know, whoever was you don't like was wrong. But if they're wrong about that, that is a disaster. And I guess at the end of the day, you know, my kind of Strong Towns thinking is like, if on one hand things kind of work out and I guess we can get back to the crappy normal, and on the other hand, it's disaster, like that's a game I don't want to play.
Right. Well, it's a little scary when, you know, bringing it back down to the local level, the way we've built our cities is fundamentally an experiment as well. And we're already unstable in that experiment. I kind of wonder when it's going to get to the point where we stop running these super risky experiments and start, you know, I'd rather have a lot of really, really tiny experiments than these super risky city to state to federal scale experiments that have real ramifications for real people. This is not a game.
I run the risk of sounding really kooky answering this, but I feel like we're closer to being able to see this as opposed to having it sound kooky. So I'm going to go ahead and do it. Part of the people who argue for like a gold standard at the federal level, they're looked at as like, you know, backward, antiquated people who are stuck in the past and don't get modern economics and what have you. I've always looked at it differently. And I've always thought that we would turn to that. And if you look in the past, when economies have gone off like stable backing of their currency and gone to other things, when they go back is when society reaches a point where the level of chaos and tumult is so bad that they say, just make it stop. And I'm going to use an analogy here that may make some people angry. Please just be generous with me and be patient. When we look at the current presidential administration, there's a lot of people, and I think even a lot of people would be inclined to support the administration itself because they support the party or what have you, that have just gotten to the point where they're like, make it stop. Like, make the tweeting stop, make the crazy stop. Like, I just want it to stop. And I think we see that in a lot of places in society when we're exposed to chaos. And really right now, what we're seeing is economic chaos. the natural inclination of human beings is not to say, let's just try this bigger experiment and ride this out. You might do that because you're afraid of the change. But ultimately, you get to a point where you're just like, we have to have stability, like make it stop. I actually think the idea of going to a gold standard, or essentially like tying our economy to something stable, may be like the only thing ultimately that gets us out of this like craziness, because I think it will continue until enough people just get to the point where they say like, make it stop. I can't handle the not knowing what tomorrow will bring.
Well, this conversation has officially gone over my head, talking about currency. I think that those are all very interesting points. And I don't know a lot about the currency system in general. It's something that I've been trying to learn more about, but it is complicated and very interesting to think about, though.
But look at it as just a human. This is the thing about cities and city budgets, too. If we back up a year, it was very easy to make the case that maybe we should borrow a bunch of money and maybe we should take on this experiment and subsidize this business and do this thing, because we all like had past experience of the last decade being limited volatility. And the Cassandras who stood up and said, oh, but you know, what about 2008? And what about this? They were kind of poo-pooed away. Like, we don't need to listen to that. That happened once and we got over that and we can do it again. And now all of a sudden there's this really like abject fear, particularly at City Hall, of like, you know, we're way beyond our skis here. Like we're in some place where like, it's not going to be just trim 10% here and lay off some people. And boy, that's painful. We're talking about rethinking entire systems of governance at the local level. If you stood up today and said those same things, you know, we're going to take on a bunch of debt and run these projects and provide all these subsidies and do the, I think people would say, wait, stop. Like, that's crazy. This is too much. I think what we will see is that the volatility will make us prudent. I'm not going to use the word conservative because I think that that gets mixed up with the politics. I'll use the word prudent. I think that we will naturally become more prudent as opposed to, you know, more gamblers. The irony of that is that at the federal level, our reaction has become more gamblers. And so I think that that is where the tension is going to end up in our economy, is what makes sense at the local level. And this is kind of a rip on Keynes, or a riff on Keynes. What makes sense at the local level in terms of volatility is the exact opposite of what the federal government is trying to do. And that's really going to be the tension at City Hall. Make it stop. Like, I want stability. Don't do crazy stuff. And the federal government's like, we need you to do crazy stuff because we got to keep this whole game going.
Yikes. Well, it will be interesting to see where this all ends up in terms of how local governments are able to respond to the gap that many of them are going to face in their revenue budget. I think that this is a good tune to end this discussion. But before we do, we're going to go into the down zone, which is the part of the show where we share what we've been listening to, reading, or anything else that has been keeping us entertained this week. Chuck, do you have anything you'd like to contribute to the down zone?
I took last Saturday, which is the day between obviously Good Friday and Easter, and worked out in the yard. And it was actually kind of like peaceful, just me by myself out in the yard when we had a nice day. And I listened to the book Ghost Soldiers by Hampton Sides. It was an account of the rescue of some POWs from the Bataan Death March at the beginning of World War II. Towards the end of the war, as the Americans were closing in on this prison camp, the Japanese started to just kill all the prisoners. And a group of Rangers did this really daring, crazy raid to get to the prison camp before everybody could be killed. And this is a story of what they did and how they did it. And it's astounding. It's a really, it's a quick book. It's a easy, it's like 6 hours long. It's very easy to listen to. It was a well-done story, but it's also just one of these, wow, humans are capable of amazing things. Amazing, terrible, and beautiful things all simultaneously.
Well, that sounds really nice. We actually haven't had a very nice week this week in terms of the weather. It's been pretty cold, and I've officially hit the point in this quarantine when I'm starting to get a little bit stir crazy. So that has led me to start thinking of projects that I might want to do around the house, which has started with our backyard. We basically have a very, very small backyard that would make a great courtyard. And so during some of my evenings this week, I went on SketchUp and modeled our lot and our house and basically designed this very extravagant project for our very tiny backyard that was a great surprise to my husband when I showed him this.
Hey, I'm a planner. Let me show you how I plan.
Well, and you know, I'm not a landscape designer. And he actually, that's his profession is that. So he was a little bit like, whoa, because he knows that we are going to do most of the project ourselves. He knows how to do all the technical stuff, and I'm more of the like the laborer person. So he was a little bit overwhelmed, like, I'm not sure that's going to work. But it was a proposal that I spent a little bit of time on this week just to keep myself entertained and you know, get a sense of some things that I can do when the weather starts getting nice.
That is beautiful. And we had snow this week, but it's gone now. We're supposed to have 2 days this weekend of above 50 degrees with sun. It's going to be a lot of pale skin out there in Minnesota. Because 50 degrees is when we put shorts on and start walking around outside and being like, wow, this is really nice. So if you're in Minnesota, you can look forward to that.
I don't put shorts on until it hits about 80 degrees. And then I'm probably still cold. I'm kind of not the type of person that does very, very well in cold weather, which, you know, Kansas City is moderately cold, but not as cold as Minnesota.
Minnesota is so warm. You got to come here. No one here is going to ever complain about the cold. It gets a little chilly sometimes, but we can handle it.
Well, all right. I guess that concludes this show. Thank you guys, everybody, for listening to another episode of Upzoned. Keep doing what you can to build a strong town.